Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's my turn and I chose a story by Sylvia Plath called The 59th Bear. And I picked this one because a listener had actually written in suggesting a different Sylvia Plath short story and then we weren't able to find it online. So I figured I'll find one that is online and we can add her to the list here. Often in daydreams, Norton saw himself in the role of a widower, a hollow-cheeked, Hamlet-esque figure in somber suits given to standing, abstracted, ravaged by casual winds, on lonely promontories, and at the rails of ships, Sadie's slender, elegant white body embalmed in a kind of bas-relief on the central tablet of his mind. It never occurred to Norton that his wife might outlive him. Her sensuousness, her simple pagan enthusiasms, her inability to argue in terms of anything but her immediate emotions, this was too flimsy, too gossamery as stuff to survive out from under the wings of his guardianship. As he had guessed, Sadie's jaunt on her own was anything but satisfactory. The pool boiled up right enough, a perfectly lovely shade of blue, but a freakish shift in wind flung the hot steam in her face and nearly scalded her to death. And somebody, some boy or group of boys, had spoken to her on the boardwalk and spoiled the whole thing. A woman could never be alone in peace. A solitary woman was a walking invitation to all sorts of impudence. All this Norton knew was a bid for his company, but since the incident of the water bag, a revulsion from the crowds of tourists had been simmering at the base of his skull. When he thought of going out into the mobs again, his fingers twitched. He saw himself from a great distance from Olympus, pushing a child into a steaming pool, punching a fat man in the belly, his headache stabbed back out of the blue like a vulture's beak. "Why don't we leave the rest till tomorrow," he said. "Then I'd feel up to walking around with you. Today's our last day." Norton couldn't think of an answer to that. It was only when they passed the 57th bear that he realized how upset Sadie was. The bear lay stretched into the road ahead of them, a ponderous brown sphinx occupying a pool of sunlight. Sadie could not have missed seeing him. She had to pull out into the left lane to get around, but she set her lips and said nothing, accelerated, and shot them past a bend in the road. Norton remembered hearing of a child who never turned his anger on the objects or people around him, but he threw himself on the floor, kicking and crying, "I'll break my legs, I'll break my legs." Sadie was driving recklessly now. When they came to the junction near the great rainbow pools, she drove by so fast that a group of people about to cross the road jumped back in alarm, and the ranger with them yelled out angrily, "Hey, slow down there." A few hundred yards beyond the junction, Sadie began to cry. Her face puckered up and her nose reddened. Tears streamed into the corners of her mouth and over her chin. Had you read this one before?
No. I realized when you sent this over, I'd never read any Sylvia Plath. And
me neither.
I was disappointed in myself when I realized that because I was like, oh, she wrote short stories and I never read one. So I was very excited to read this one.
Yeah, I had never read any of her stuff either, which is similarly embarrassing. I feel like this is one of those writers that you know a lot about, but unless it was like assigned to me in high school, it wasn't something I was going to reach for. It feels like somehow outdated and I know that it's not. I recently thrifted a copy of The Bell Jar because I was like, I've not read this, so yeah. I should probably read it. It costs $1.50. And anyway, this listener had suggested a different one of hers, and so this was one that I found online. And to explain the title, because I don't know that it's obvious, they're on a trip to Yellowstone and they've made a guess about how many bears they're going to see.
Obviously, all of our listeners, every single one of them has already read the story before they listen.
Yes.
They've come to their own conclusions, they've analyzed the story, they've gotten all the symbolism out of it. We don't need to tell them those things because they're not using our podcast to write their own papers.
Yeah, so if you're a student, you don't need to listen anymore. So they're counting bears on their trip, and they just saw 57. She wants to see 59. Apparently, it's like her lucky number, and he made a guess, I think, like 71.
Yeah.
And so her refusal to acknowledge this bear at the end is what really puts him over the edge and makes him realize that she's very upset. She doesn't even want to count the 57th bear.
He's like, "I have a headache. You can enjoy this place on your own," but she's like grumpy about it. And then he's like, "Oh, she didn't even say anything when we passed that bear, number 57.
Shh. She must be upset.
Probably a little upset by what's happening. So let me change my attitude a little bit. And that's when he suggests, oh, maybe it's a little small bit of sunstroke and we haven't eaten for a while. So let's eat. We'll feel better.
He's like, I know how to cheer her up. You're hungry. And it kind of works, right? I mean, they do kind of cheer up after that.
Well, he eats something and he feels a little better so he can be more attentive, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, the way he talks about her, because we're in his point of view, it's like hard to know how much he likes her. This is like a honeymoon. And he's like, oh, she couldn't survive without me. She's also like weak.
Oh, he seems to really like her because there's little moments when he's like, oh man, I couldn't imagine. Like, he finds such comfort in her. Like when they get into the sleeping bag, and just his reaction to the bear when he sees the bear at the end. It's like, how could he do that to her hat? That wonderful hat of hers. I question her feelings to him. Like when he believes, from his point of view, he's believing that she is reliant on him. Her actions seem to support that. And yet, the story seems to suggest that she summoned this bear to kill him.
Yeah, by the end, he's not sure if
we are not sure.
He's not sure if she's excited or terrified.
Oh, yeah.
That the 59th bear has decided to kill him. I guess what makes me think that he's like, I know that this is like their honeymoon or whatever. And like you said, he adores her in some ways. But as I'm reading this, I'm like, this is not going to last. Mostly because he views her as so fragile. And he's talking about how he wants her to win the bet. Basically, it would be easier if she won the bet. Because it says Norton had set his figure carelessly at 71. In secret, he had hoped Sadie would win. She took games seriously like a child. Losing wounded her. She was so trusting. And above all, she trusted her luck. He knows her really well. And maybe in some ways he's like amused by her. But other times I'm reading this and I'm like, he really does think of her as not as a woman, as like as a kid.
I mean, that moment I took more metaphorically. But one thing about this story, when I was finished with it, I don't usually look up anything. But I was curious to know what Sylvia Plath thought of this story. For some reason, I was like, what was she trying to do with this story?
She hated it.
That's what I was about to say. I discovered that she apparently hated this story. She said, a stiff artificial piece about a man killed by a bear, ostensibly because his wife willed it to happen, but none of the deep emotional undercurrents gone into or developed. And then she said, I just can't get outside myself. I was like, that is an interesting thing, because this seems to be an attempt to write a story from a point of view that's not hers. But everything about his point of view is about his wife. It's all his thoughts about his wife. It's all his reactions to her. And in that way, I don't know, but I do wonder if that's what she was thinking of. It's like she tried to get outside, she tried to write a story from a point of view that's not her own. Because her poetry is about herself, right? This is one of her innovations. Like, she was part of that school of poets that was like very much writing personal expressions at that time. But if in this story she's trying to write from a different point of view, like, I'm going to pick the husband as a point of view to write from, she nevertheless made the story about the wife and the husband's feelings about the wife, which makes me, in retrospect, think, I wonder if her disappointment was that it was too focused on her, and in that way too accurate. Like, the husband knew her too well, or his feelings about her were too correct the way she wanted them to be. I don't know. That was a thought. But that line, I just can't get outside myself, I was like thinking about that a lot.
Yeah, I read that. I came across the same passage you did. And not having read her other stuff, sometimes I don't think it's a terrible thing not to be able to get outside of yourself. Sometimes so many writers are writing the same story over and over again, and they're still great, you know? Sometimes, like, you reach and you try for something else, and it's like, this isn't your strength. You shouldn't be able to write everything well. And for as upset as maybe she was about this story, and like you said, it's kind of hard to know exactly where we're supposed to land. There's sections, and there's, like, a command of language, and I think, like, great insight into these characters that even in her least favorite piece, you can glimpse, you know, what it is that makes her stand out.
Well, I mean, she can be really good at doing the thing she has done a lot of, and still, I sympathize with that idea. Like,
yeah,
I just want to try something else. I just want to be able to do other things. And this is one of my attempts at it, and it fell short. And it's like, okay, she's still an astonishingly good writer and able to pull off really good stuff. But if this story were an attempt to do something slightly different, and it just came off as like, it's still good, but in the other way, and not quite what I was trying to do, you know, it's still good. It's just not quite what she wanted.
I feel like that's what happens when you try something new. it's not going to land the first time. I don't know how much she tried to get out of her own head after this, right? How many times she tried to do the new different thing. But even if you're really good at the one thing, you got to learn how to do the other. I sometimes will try to write like in a different voice, and within a few paragraphs, I'm back to my own normal stuff because it's hard to even like sustain.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that on a recent episode about my point of view is that stories have voices, not authors, or should. But if people are interested, it was the Dennis Johnson one. It was Work. We talked about that. Voice is about perspective for me, and each story has its own perspective, and the perspective kind of dictates the way the story is told, the kind of style of it. And I don't know. I don't know what Sylvia Plath's thoughts were ultimately. I want to read more of her stuff. I want to read her journals because they sound interesting. But this line about not being able to get outside herself stuck with me. It just sounds like it's a perspective thing to me. I can't get outside myself feels like a perspective thing, which in my mind also changes voice. This is a challenge I set for myself as a writer.
Yeah.
I don't have to necessarily apply it to all writers, but for myself, I think if I want to be the best writer, what I want to aim for is to be able to change perspectives and voices between stories as much as I need to. I mean, the stories I choose to write are all probably going to be within a certain narrow range. I'm not going to write certain stories because I won't have an attachment to those stories.
Yeah, exactly.
But I should be able to have some breadth of voice or perspective in order to do that. And if that is what she was disappointed in, then I feel a connection there. That's one thing about this story is because I feel like when I got to the end of it, I was like, that's such a well-told story and it's so well realized, but I don't know what it's doing. Like, it's basically just this couple having kind of a sometimes fun, sometimes tedious, sometimes exciting, sometimes boring vacation. And then at the end, the guy is killed by a bear. And I'm like, is there more to it? And it seems like she doesn't feel like she pursued it to its fullest potential. Might be what she was disappointed in.
Yeah, and I think anything that I could say to point out like a stronger sort of conclusion would be like reading between the lines and guessing.
Oh, yeah.
Because we don't really know what the wife is thinking, and the only guess that we have is in his description of her cry at the end there. So at the end, they're like laying in their tent and they hear the bear outside, and she sits up and she says, "My bear," because it should be number 59.
It's number 59.
And he thinks to himself, like, did she conjure it? Like, did she call it? She doesn't say the 59th bear. She says my bear, like it's here.
Yeah, it's like she ordered food. It's my lunch.
Yeah,
my lunch is here.
Oh, my
it's
Uber
my bear
eats.
My bear got here. Oh, good.
Yeah. And then so they can like hear it getting into their stuff.
The other part before that,
yeah,
this is more concretely her bear in another way, because before they ever get back to the campsite for driving, she makes this comment. They still haven't gotten gas. They're wondering if it's gonna run out, and she says, even if we get gas, even if we make it to the gas station and get gas, even if we make this, there will be two more bad things. There will be a trailer parked in our car space and a bear waiting at the tent. And both of those things happened. Bear number 58 was sitting by their tent and it wandered off. And they didn't see their tent at first because there was a trailer parked there. And they don't remark on it. They don't say, oh, turns out Sadie was right. There's no commentary about like that, but it was fulfilled. And so when she says at the end, as you were about to talk about, oh, it's my bear, like there's a suggestion that she's conjuring these things. Because there's, even before that, there's the suggestion that he, Norton, was controlling the animals. He's like summoning the elk to run across. But then there is a line, there was a stronger will at work here than his.
Yes. Yes.
So there's some mysticism in this, and as far as like who is bringing about these encounters.
Yeah. So whether or not she's like willed the bear there, like, you know, because he spends a lot of time at the beginning too talking about how 59's her lucky number.
Yeah. It's not just a random number.
No. Like, what power does she have over the situation? But then at the end here, she's also the one that like repeatedly says, do something. She says, do something, go shoo him away. And he looks outside and he sees the bear ruining her hat. And then he gets really upset and he says, stay here, I'm going to drive that bear off. And she says, take the light, that'll scare it. So he's kind of like she's the one that hears it, she's the one that says that's my bear, she's the one that says go do it, and he's like, don't worry, I'm gonna do it.
Oh, that's where the line is. It's right at the end. He takes the flashlight that he hands to her, goes to the car, and he's like get out, and then at any moment the bear should break into a shuffle and be off. Get out. But there was another will working, a will stronger even than his. That's when her will seems to be taking over rather than him controlling the animals. But that's like that you're suggesting, like, I feel like that's the hidden, the depth that we get a glimpse of, but don't get elucidated.
I kind of read this, and when I sat back and thought about it, based on what we do know, and based on the fact that at the end here, like the biggest, most tense scene, he has this thought that he's not sure if his wife is happy that he's being killed by the bear, or happy that bear number 59 is here, or scared that he is being killed. He has a thought in his literal final moments that he's not totally sure if his wife wants him to die. And then it's like through that context that I'm reevaluating his thoughts on her. And
Oh, I
the
see,
only thing
yeah.
I could like read into it is like he thinks like she's incapable without him. She's delicate and frail. There's another section where he talks about in their second year of marriage, she was unwilling to go anywhere without him, even the grocery store. She clung to him again like a child. And when he follows her like through the crowds and things, he's just kind of like he's enamored by her and he's attracted to her, but I don't think he thinks of her as having like as being fully capable without him. And so it's in this final moment where yes, she does demand that he go and do something and save her. But he can't, and he gets gotten. And then he's kind of wondering to himself, is this what she wanted all along? So, like, the only hint that we get as to what she might be thinking is that she's like, I don't know, maybe pretty aware of what he thinks of her. And this is like a way that she can get back at him. I don't know. I don't know what he's thinking in that moment. But, like, based on what we had, that was all I could sort of draw on was a person that he underestimated.
I mean, the words excitement, but there's all kinds of different kinds of excitement. You know, is she excited because something she's been hoping for is coming to fruition? Is she excited because it's just an exciting thing? It's like peaking, PIQUE. It's like something that gets you amped up. Like if she felt coldly to him, that would be another thing, right? And maybe part of her disappointment was that this ending does put everything back into the wife character. And she's like, no, I wanted it to be more about him, but it turns out to be about her.
Yeah, if this were going to be more about him, there would have to be like we were talking before we started this recording about the idea of like a character's like fatal flaw being what drives an ending. If I were to read it that way, I'd have to make the leaps that I outlined before, that his fatal flaw is underestimating his wife somehow. And that's not fully realized. It's a guess based on what I do know. So with an ending like this, for it to be his ending and his story, you would expect there to be something that was sort of inevitable about it. It'd be different if this was a character, Norton, who acted like he owned Yellowstone and took really strong command of his wife the whole time and was really cocky and bold. It might make sense that he goes and confronts a bear and gets killed by it. But that's not really what's happening here. He seems sort of like dragged along and then pushed out of the tent. And then he kind of realizes he's going to rise to the occasion because he's upset in the moment, but he's also underestimating the bear. Yeah, so it's hard to know what the ending is supposed to tell us. The other thing that I came across when I was sort of reading about it was talking about, you know, man versus nature, which I also don't think that's what this story is about. But I thought it was fascinating. I've never been to Yellowstone, but there's a couple scenes here where like the tourists are taking pictures of like the elk. They're just up close and personal. We have so many stories these days of people, you know, taking the photos and getting in trouble or getting too close to an animal and all this kind of stuff. I was blown away that they encountered 59 bears. I mean,
Seems
I
like
lived
a
in
lot.
Florida for 10 years and I feel like I saw 30. And when I say I saw 30, I think I saw the same one in my yard night after night. You know what I mean? But it wasn't like this was of a different time and place. And I felt like that was pretty well captured. I felt like I could see and understand what it's like to just be in this place that's overtaken by tourists and each of them acting sort of stupidly. He jokes about how he's in such a foul mood that he doesn't want to go be with the crowds. He pictures himself like punching a guy. And I think that's pretty funny too. Like all of this is like well captured where there's just so many people, and it's just sort of a miserable way to experience like nature.
Yeah, I don't know that the story is about that. It has that in it, except for her seeming connection to the bears and his seeming connection to like other animals, the elk and stuff. But it's not like they have the best relationship with it either. They're not like connected because they're nicer, right? They're doing the same touristy things everybody else is doing. There's a comment about like some campers are dumb and they put food in their tents, so the bears go in the tents. It's like anyone who goes camping knows you're not supposed to do that, or anyone who knows anything about camping knows you're not supposed to do that. Some people go camping and don't know anything. It's the same kind of thing with what you were saying before about her. If it were more about her, we should get clearer distinctions of whether he's right about her or not. It feels the same way if that's the focus of the story, it's this connection with the natural world, we should get more distinctions, more kind of moral comments, right? These people are bad because they do this, and these people are good because they do this. I don't feel like that's really there. It feels very touristy overall. All the characters are tourists.
And they're none of them is at their best, but maybe they're also like their worst is their real selves. So the other section we haven't talked about is how they nearly run out of gas. Well, they do, but they make it to a gas station and then they're like back on the road. At one point, they're like singing a song and he forgets the words to it. It says, "Forgetting the words disturbed Norton. He had known them by heart, surely
She
as his
took
name,
over,
but
right?
yeah, she takes over and she remembers them." I almost got the sense that he was more disturbed that she remembered them because he was like, "Wait a second, like I kick this off." And then she makes that comment, like you said, where, you know, even if we get our gas, there's going to be two more problems, trailer in our space and a bear at the tent. But they make it into the lit gas station. And it says, 20 minutes later, they were driving into the lit gas station, chuckling like two giddy adolescents. The engine died 5 yards from the pump. Norton hadn't seen Sadie so merry since the start of their trip. And then he goes on to talk about how, like, even the crowds stressed her out and she got hysterical one day when he wandered off for a minute. She came and found him and she was like sobbing. And now he describes the empty tank and the unpeopled road affecting her like brandy. Her exhilaration bewildered him. He just can't handle these ups and downs of hers. And then they get their gas and then they go back to the tent. He just seems to be like on the trip like for her. And so the fact that he also dies at the end, I'm like, this is just me like trying to read into it, you know, because I don't know that it's all there.
So she wrote this late in her life, a very short life, but I do wonder if she wrote it before or after learning about her husband's affair when he went off to London. This is one of the problems with biography and reading a story and knowing too much about the author is you wonder where the connections are with real life. Like, were the feelings the characters share between them in the story informed by the feelings of the real people from whom they were likely modeled? Did she glimpse his disconnection a little bit?
Yeah, she reading into all of his like disinterest in this trip as being of something more, and are her fits of hysteria overwhelming to him because he doesn't realize that they're in response to something else?
And when she learned of, she had a few suicide attempts in her life, and one of them is uncertain whether it was a suicide attempt, is when she found out about the affair and she just goes driving into this field. And she said later that it was apparently, she was really upset. She wasn't trying to hurt herself at that moment. She was just super upset, and like the energy of that made her drive off into the field. So she obviously had very strong feelings about everything. So I can see those really strong feelings in this character too. But what are they pointed at? And that's the problem with biography. It's not in the story. So I don't like ascribing it to the story, but you can't help it sometimes.
Especially if the criticism she has about the piece is that she couldn't step outside herself.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess I'm not sure totally what my takeaway is. I was thoroughly surprised that this ended the way it did. And from everything we've said, maybe this is not our favorite piece or anything, but I really enjoyed
Oh, I still like it.
sort of like reading and feeling this. I was sort of confused. I was like, no, this isn't ending this way, you know? Because you could tell
That's
how many
right.
paragraphs and pages are left, and it's going to be an encounter with a bear, and it's going to be him, and oh no. So I liked how by the end, I was actually shocked sort of by the ending. A lot of times my favorite stories are sort of quiet ones, you know, with like a powerful, like emotional punch. And there was certainly that part of it, but just like plot-wise, it just ends on this as horrifically as it can. And it made me think that I had this feeling of like, go for it, you know, like the next time you write a story, just like, what's the craziest thing that could happen at the end? Not out of left field necessarily, but what's the worst that could happen in that situation? Like, stories don't have to end happily, certainly, but they also don't have to end practically. I mean, this just feels like we're just gonna kill him. And we're not gonna see like what happens afterwards either. Story ends here for him. So I like the idea of going into a story with that mindset and kind of just like, you know, you could end it one of 100 ways, but what if the 101 way is the craziest version of it? And what if that's like what's like surprising and memorable for your readers?
My takeaway that I've come to through our conversation is very much kind of building on that, because what we talked about so much was how can we resolve this ending with everything that happened in the story leading up to it. Like, how do we use the ending to reflect back on the story and find the clues, find the pieces that let us make sense of it?
Right.
Is it about him? Is it about her? Who's controlling what? What are their feelings about what's happening? Those are all the questions we had, and we were trying to find those answers in the story. And that leads to my takeaway is, like, when you find your ending, ask those questions. Figure out what it means for everything else. Like, how does it reflect back on the story? And make sure it's probably too strong, but, like, consider whether you need to put the answers into it.
Right.
Consider whether those answers should be part of the story. My inkling is to say they should be. I'm sure
if
they come up with a reason they shouldn't, there's probably places where it works out okay even if you don't. But in general, if you want your story to be fully satisfying, like not leaving too many unanswered questions, so it satisfies all the reasonable questions that can be asked of it, you should find a way to answer those reasonable questions.
I was going to say, like, or maybe, like, be explicit about it. Maybe what we're struggling with here is that the answers are supposedly in the story, but they're not. We're not being pointed to them strongly enough. You know what I mean?
That could be. Yeah. This is just my takeaway. I'm not trying to say, like, whether the story did or didn't do this, but the seeking for those things leads me to realize that that's a thing that we should make sure we think about when we finish our stories, because we don't want to be left in a position where, oh, I should have said that.
Yes. All right. Thanks, guys. If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.